This edition of the ACAP Coffee Break podcast is supported by Claris Health. Claris Health is a solution-oriented partner who understands where the payment integrity industry is headed next. Claris Health's Perio is the industry's only enterprise AI-enabled payment integrity platform that maximizes health plan avoidance and recoveries at the most optimized cost. With all of your claims over payment processes, analytics, and insights at your fingertips, what goals could you reach? Find out more by visiting clarishealth.com today. Now, let's get back to the coffee break. Hello there, and welcome back to the ACAP Coffee Break, a podcast from the Association for Community Affiliated Plans. In today's episode, ACAP CEO Meg Murray speaks with Rob Robinson, CEO of Alliance Health. Here's Meg.
Today we have Rob Robinson from Alliance Health joining us, who runs a health plan that focuses on behavioral health issues in North Carolina. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, Meg. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, we always start off with the question of how did you get to healthcare? Why healthcare and not some other field? What is your story?
Well, Meg, that's a good question. So, you know, I'm sure I took the traditional path like everyone else, right? So I graduated from college with a degree in public justice. At that time, I was interested in law. And then I quickly learned I wasn't smart enough to become an attorney. So I did the next best thing, which was bartend. So I bartended for about a year, making ends meet, you know, doing things like playing intramural sports. I was sort of finding myself right after that time of college. Then my grandfather, about a year after, my grandfather was a mentor to me. He wasn't up until that point, but he grabbed me and said, you know what? He started a bunch of alcohol and drug treatment programs, outpatient programs in New York State. He was actually in New York. The how you are credentialed and given a number is based on where you fall in line. So he was substance abuse counselor number three, right? So he helped develop that whole program. And he said, why don't you come over, try this work? People seem to like you. And I said, sure. I didn't really have anything else to do other than bartend. So I did begin working in an outpatient treatment program. I started as a volunteer, then I went part-time, then I went full-time. And then I think at the age of 24 or 25, they gave me my own clinic to run. So up until the point they gave me the clinic, so I was treating people for addiction counseling during the day and bartending at night. If you know anything about the alcohol and drug field, the pay is not very good. So to make ends meet, I was bartending at night. And this went on for a while until I ran into one of my clients. This is an absolute true story. Ran into one of my clients in a bar at night. He was hammered and he came up to me and couldn't have been more thankful about how I saved his life. I was the greatest thing to ever happen to him. Again, the guy was completely hammered. He was in an intensive outpatient treatment program and I was bartending. I didn't serve him a drink, but he asked me to serve him a drink. So that's when I decided I need to make a switch. And so I stuck with addiction. And while I was doing that, I began seeing a lot of kids. I was getting referrals from the court system, from probation, from attorneys asking if I would see these kids. And again, I had no idea what I was doing. I wasn't trained to be a counselor. For some reason, I just got through this. I think a lot of it is, according to some of my peers, I acted just like them. I had some of the same maturity level as them. And somehow these kids were doing okay through this work. And then, so I was doing that for a while. And then, you know, again, in upstate New York, north of Syracuse, I got real tired of the snow. As I told you, I was running this clinic, but that included everything from shoveling snow to doing the billing, to doing payment. I even helped my grandfather build walls of the group room in there. And then the one day that I had snow, I had a suit on, snow up to my belt, shoveling with my hands to get the door open to grab the shovel. I knew that was enough. So it just so happened about a month later, I met one of my old college or my old high school friends who worked in a treatment facility in Norfolk, Virginia. He offered me a job to do intensive in-home work. So I took that job, worked for a few years in Virginia Beach. I met my wife, we got married. And then shortly after she married, she said, I'd like to move. I grew up in Virginia Beach and, you know, not thinking anything of it, being the good husband that I am. Sure, honey, we can move. We can move. Literally within 2 weeks, she had a job in North Carolina. So we packed up, or she packed up and moved, bought a house that I never saw, moved in. I applied for one job at the Derm Center as a child coordinator. I got that job, moved up a couple times, and my predecessor, she retired as the CEO. She recommended to the board that I succeed her as the CEO. The board approved that, and I've been in that role as CEO of Alliance Health since 2014. So, Meg, there's the story.
Wow.
I don't think it's ever been told before.
No, we've had interesting ways that people got to the CEO role of a health plan, but that yours is unique, definitely. So tell us then how, because it sounded like it started off as a social service agency, but then it morphed into a health plan. Tell us about that. How did it become the Alliance Health that we know today?
Yeah, so I've worked on the provider side of the house as well as with governments. You know, I've been fortunate to work with some pretty terrific people on both sides. I have, however, been with government for the past 20 years. I actually like being part of the public system. I think it's a tremendous way to make a difference. I think we're a little bit unique in that we're a government a government entity that has to compete for a business, right? So we have the structure of government, but we have to operate like a for-profit, nonprofit business competing, right? And I think that's pretty unique. I think some of the benefits of that are, you know, I don't have to worry about attending to shareholder needs, right? I don't need to make a profit to pay that out to a board. So I think I can just focus on quality of care, which I think is a cool thing. Of course, you know, I do have to do all that within budget. But the other good benefit of that is any money that we save gets reinvested back in services. The other thing about being a government entity and a safety net services, I think that we get access to places and partnerships that I believe we wouldn't get to otherwise. We have real strong relationships at the local level. I think part of it is because we are government, the partnerships that we've established with other government entities, they sort of understand it. Now, I don't want to say the downside, the flip side of that, I have several bosses, right? So I have my board, which is, of course, the top dog, but I also have the state, right, which includes the state officials as well as legislators. And I also have counties who I consider a boss, right? They appoint our board, and the board decides whether or not I should stay as a CEO, right? So all of them. So I got, you know, 50 bosses that I need to attend to between commissioners and state office officials and my board. So given that, there's an upside to that. I get a lot of support, particularly with the counties. I value those partnerships tremendously. They give us a lot of money to help serve folks that are in need, primarily those who are uninsured, underinsured. On the flip side of that, though, any of them can take me out if they want, right? Between my board, the counties can figure out a way to do it. There's the state officials can do it. And the General Assembly can just write a quick bill and I'm no longer in business. So definitely pros and cons, but I will say most of it is definitely on the positive side.
But the organization started off as a provider group, right? And when did you become a health plan?
Yeah, good question. So when I joined the Derm Center, they were a community mental health center just beginning to transition to an LME, which which stands for local management entity. And that is about managing care for people who are uninsured, underinsured, using state and county dollars. So we were in the midst of that transition. That took place around 2002. It went on for a year or so. And then we went from an LME, right, just managing state and county dollars, to an LME MCO, managing services for people with Medicaid. Now, we were doing that as a carve out. So we were just managing behavioral health, substance use, and IDD services.
And under the new contract, tell us how your role there has changed, because you're serving a different population a little bit now, right?
Yeah. So I'll try and hit the highlights of that. It can be a little bit complicated. So North Carolina is in the midst of Medicaid transformation, which is really about bringing managed care to North Carolina. North Carolina is one of the last states to bring managed care statewide. What is unique about North Carolina, they did do this carve out with the LME MCOs. They did that back in 2012, 2013. But the rest of the state was fee for service. So the plan now is to bring managed care to the entire state. There are two parts to Medicaid transformation in North Carolina. There are the standard plans and there are the tailor plans. Both are responsible for integrated whole person care. There are a couple of differences between what is offered in each plan. So for the standard plan, there are five that operate statewide. There's actually one that operates regionally, but for the most part, there are five statewide. They do compete for business against each other. They are responsible for individuals with mild to moderate mental health and substance use disorders. And we define mild to moderate as individuals who are not receiving behavioral health treatment or receiving basic outpatient. The other type of the plan and the one near and dear to my heart is the Taylor plan. We will be responsible for individuals with severe mental health, severe substance use, just about everybody with an intellectual and developmental disability, and everybody with a TBI or traumatic brain injury, right? And we are serving that population now, behavioral health, IDD, and substance use services, as well as physical health, as well as managing the pharmacy benefit for this population. The other difference between the Taylor plan, standard plan, is the Taylor plan will have more of an enhanced service array, and they will also be able to offer care management. So we're excited about this. I think it's the right thing to do. I'm glad the state is doing this. Integrated care, whole person care, we've been dabbling in it, but now we'll have the full authority and responsibility for doing that.
So as a result, then you've had to learn how to contract with the PBM, I assume, and provide other services that you hadn't provided in the past.
That's correct. You know, we're trying to leverage organizations that do this, particularly for areas that are specialized, like a PBM. We do have a contract with a PBM. We're also contracting with one of the standard plans to help perform some of the responsibilities under the Taylor plan. Of course, we have vision and all the other things as well.
So what do you think will be some of the challenges that you're facing as you move into this?
So, Meg, this is new for us. We are bringing on the talent to help manage the physical health. And of course, we've contracted with the PBM to help manage the pharmacy benefit. But I think the biggest challenge for us, and I know this is not unique just to Alliance, are the workforce issues, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's been a pretty significant issue. The issue has been exacerbated through COVID. What's happening is there creates a supply and demand issue, right? Right now, the demand for services is greater than the supply. We've lost about 119 beds, residential beds for kids in North Carolina. That may not seem like a lot, but we had a little bit of shortage going into COVID. And we're a state that's one of the fastest growing states in the country. And it's really posing a problem for us. So providers, what the problem is, providers are able to pick and choose who to serve. And there was one provider I talked to last week that's got a wait list of 75, right? And I know that's not unique. I know people have more of a wait list, but individuals with more severe, complex needs, multiple disruptions, that's the group that's getting a little bit left behind. We're trying to solve for that problem and work with providers to build out capacity, but it's going to take some time, right? The workforce issue is not an issue that can be solved by one entity. That's got to be a joint and a comprehensive effort to make sure we do have folks willing to step in and serve some of these folks that we're talking about.
When you talk about workforce, so you're talking about provider workforce, but do you have the same issue in recruiting staff to work at the plan?
We've been fortunate, Meg. There's a couple of areas that we've struggled with. Nurses, of course, is an issue for us. We've had a little bit in IT. That was the area probably biggest concern. We're in the research triangle, IT department, IT organizations everywhere, technology everywhere. We've been pretty good at being able to maintain the group we have. We got some awesome players within our IT department, but overall we've been okay. I'm more worried about providers than I am about us.
The other thing that North Carolina is known for is the innovations that are going on there related to social determinants of health. Can you talk to us about what your plan is doing to address SDOH?
You know, like many other health plans, addressing social determinants of health is not new. We think advancing this work inside healthcare and specifically inside a health plan is a challenge and an opportunity. I think we started, you know, to make more of a concerted effort back around 2004, 2005 to address the needs of this population. We did it through implementing a system of care. When we did it, we didn't think we were doing this great novel thing or we were, you know, developing this whole new model. It was really done out of necessity. The folks we were responsible for, particularly folks with high needs, weren't participating in treatment, right? Or were they getting better? And it was due to, you know, multitude of social, family, transportation, housing issues that really plagued them. So we've expanded our work over the years. We do have a really large team responsible for helping to address social determinants of health for our members. You know, one of the things we've always debated, and I always wonder if other health plans have debated this idea as well, is do we invest our own money, meaning the plan's money, in addressing social determinants of health, or do we focus on developing partnerships with community-based organizations whose sole responsibility is to address a particular issue, right? So we've had that over the years. Our money's for treatment. We're paying for things like, you know, food and housing and all that. I will tell you kind of where we landed right now is we're going to do a mix. We do have folks out there working with the key stakeholders to try and set up relationships and partnerships to prioritize our group, and that we're investing heavily. In particular, we invest heavily in housing. The other thing that we're doing is how do we embed the work we do in the community to address social determinants of health? How do we embed that into our managed care model, right? I think we've always viewed it, and this isn't the right term, but it's kind of as a nicety. If we had a care manager, you know, just couldn't find a placement for someone, you know, our housing team would help get them housing, right? We never were able to measure, did that intervention, did paying for that person housing work, right? We can all say, yes, it did. Person probably got better off it. But I'd like to move our agency, and this we're doing this with the help of ACAP and the project you have going on, to really make it part of our model, just like paying claims, just like authorizing services, just like doing compliance. The work we do is part of the model, and we want to be able to evaluate the effectiveness and the impact of the work we do on our members, right? So that's the next step for us, and I know we'll get there. We're starting to see some of the results of this work, but we've got a little bit to go.
You mentioned housing. Can you say specifically what you're doing on housing?
We are essentially buying access to apartments and to rentals for our folks, right? And then we also pay for support, housing support.
And the rental units that you're setting aside for your members, are they respite for respite care or for permanent housing?
Permanent housing.
Are you paying the rent then for members, or you're just...
We do short-term housing assistance while they get permanent a voucher.
Oh, okay. So you pay like the first 2 or 3 months.
Yes. And we pay, you know, turn the lights on and, you know, get utilities turned on and get clothing and whatever else you need to be in the apartment, and then work through the housing association to get the rest that they need, the funding.
Thank you for sharing your story as well as your agency's story. But now I wanted to know, what stories are you reading at night? We always like to close on what books people are reading, or what other things that they're consuming to kind of take their mind off of work and rejuvenate themselves.
One of the books I got, I actually got this from my executive assistant for Christmas. So I just opened it up. It's called Originals. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's subtitled How Nonconformists Move the World by Adam Grant. So,
I love Adam Grant.
Yeah. So I know, I have a feeling I know why she got it for me, but she was very proud to give that to me.
Well, I think you are an original. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm a piece of work. Thank
you. You're a piece of work. Well, we appreciate hearing your story of how you got to be that piece of work. And so thank you for sharing it.
You're very welcome.
That concludes this episode of the ACAP Coffee Break. You can find Rob's book recommendation and others on ACAP's Goodreads bookshelf. Check out the link in this episode's description. Find and subscribe to the ACAP Coffee Break wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again to our friends at Clara's Health for their support, and thanks to you for stopping by. Stay tuned for our next episode.